Good afternoon and welcome to Time Out, your program of informative interviews with persons of note, persons with fascinating careers, leaders of today and tomorrow, and others who will allow you to invest an hour and receive a guaranteed valuable return. So stay tuned. This is Bill Hendrickson, your host of Time Out on a cloudy and chilly day here in Carbondale, North Carolina. But the conversation will not be chilly because we're going to be talking with Dr. John Simpkins. And I found out about him by reading a long editorial that he wrote in the Raleigh newspaper several months ago. And in reading what he wrote in his editorial, said to myself, this man deserves a conversation with me if we can pin him down. You sound like a very busy man.
I am on the go for sure. And it is a pleasure to be with you today, Bill. Thank you.
Well, how long have you been with, we'll talk about MDC in a minute, but how long have you been with the MDC role in Durham?
I joined during the pandemic almost 2.5 years ago now.
Okay. And what does MDC, what do those three initials stand for?
That is often the first question I get, Bill. And
well, you may get a few more.
I say these days that MDC stands for nothing, like KFC. When we were first launched in 1967, we began as an organization called the Manpower Development Corporation, a child of the North Carolina Fund that Terry Sanford launched as part of the war on poverty, as well as the attempt to bring about significant and lasting economic change in North Carolina. And our role at the time was twofold. It was to integrate the workforce in the state and to facilitate the shift from an agrarian to an industrial economy. And from those humble beginnings, we now cover 13 states across the Southeast, from Virginia and West Virginia to the North, Florida to the South, and Texas to the West, and everything that touches those states all along the coast.
So a lot of your activity does touch some of these southern states that you mentioned in your moment ago. And a lot of your work has to do with, I guess, the majority of your function and your message has to do with southern states, the southern world.
Yes, it does. And that mission, I would say, has evolved for the 21st century in that we're focused on racial and gender equity in the South. We're focused on economic mobility in the South.
Okay. Well, as I went through your website, there's a section called Why MDC. So let's see what they said about why MDC. And it says here, I'm going to read this. MDC projects over five decades have helped Southern leaders and communities advance economic mobility for people on the margins of education, employment, economic security, and strategic philanthropy. Now, that's three lines in a paragraph, which could probably take 3 hours to explain. But we're talking about the work that these leaders have started to help mobilize the economic world of people in the South. So can you comment on that?
I can, and I might even try to put it in plain English. Our mission is threefold. One, we do research and analysis on what's happening in the region. And we also look to use that research and analysis to change systems that operate in the South, systems of employment, systems of early child care, systems that respond to the needs of children with learning differences, and to change those systems from an informed, evidence-based perspective. And the third thing we do, in addition to doing the research and changing systems, is to equip a new generation of leaders to function in those systems and to lead those systems. We call it equity-centered leadership. And we work with a number of philanthropies across the South and really across the country to establish more equitable principles, not only in their funding, so that they're funding leaders of institutions that can be community anchors, but that they're also thinking about how this impacts their own practices internally.
Okay, so thanks for that explanation of the definition. Let's move on to the next item in this list. MDC brings an abiding commitment to the work of catalyzing change in the South so that everyone, particularly our most vulnerable people, can thrive. Bringing change to catalyze how the South can help the most vulnerable people thrive. And that sounds like a tougher responsibility.
It is. And we lead from behind on that effort by really working with a variety of different organizations and institutions. So if we're talking about getting people into better paying jobs, that means working with the public school system. It means working with technical colleges and four-year colleges. And it means working with ultimate employers and government and their workforce development boards. You look at all of those things, Bill, and you might say, well, somebody ought to do something about getting those folks together and coming up with a plan. What we do is get folks together and come up with a plan.
Okay. Okay, 50 years of experience working on the ground to analyze barriers to economic success. That's kind of just what you said.
Mm-hmm.
And another thing that sounds kind of tricky, mobilizing community partners to act.
Yeah.
Design and test innovative solutions and scale solutions that work. In other words, mobilizing local people to act.
Yeah.
Not just those that you need, that need, not just those that are vulnerable, but the other local people, the major portion of the society to act.
Yes, absolutely. And there we're talking about building community and building on the strengths, the existing strengths in community, getting people together so that whatever actions government is taking actually reflect the needs and the desires of the people in the community. And a lot of the work that we do, especially in rural communities, but really in communities of various sizes all across the South, is to bring folks together to clarify what it is that they want to see. What do they want and what do they expect of their local government, of their state government, and to the extent that it's relevant for them, the federal government.
So you say, I'm reading on in this definition section, deep knowledge of the region captured through our flagship, quote, State of the South reports. The State of the South must be a document that you publish.
It is, and I'm glad you asked me about that, because not only is it a document that we publish, but it will increasingly be a way through which we will bring people together. It's going to be our public-facing platform, and we're going to have our first big public gathering under the banner of State of the South in Durham on the 27th and 28th of this month, of October.
Mm-hmm.
The evening of the 27th at the Haytai Center at 7 p.m. in Durham. And then all day on the 28th of October, that Friday, from 8:30 to 4 at North Carolina Central University. They've got a beautiful new student center there, and we're going to make use of that on Friday the 28th.
I'm glad you're doing that in that region of Durham, because I've had a couple of radio conversations with a journalist from the News and Observer about
yes.
what's happening in Haytai.
Yeah.
And it's, they now call it, what's the name of the street? Anyway, it's another name of a street there that they're calling a region.
And yeah, the Fayetteville Street region.
Yeah, the Fayetteville area. And yeah. the Durham, or the county board of planners has put together a plan for that area, and it's it's under controversy, right? Serious.
It is.
Yeah.
It is indeed. And that's one of the things we want to look at as we're thinking about what does change look like at the community level across the region. That's a very specific example of how change is occurring and what we'd want to do that works and what we want to do that's different. So this event's going to be free and open to the public, and I hope you and all your listeners will think about joining us.
Oh, I will. I'm so glad you brought that up. I drove through that area a couple of months ago and was just astounded at it's just wasteland, all wasteland, which is there from the resulting of the throughway that was built some years ago, which tore down homes. There's nothing but foundations. If you haven't driven through there, do it. Take your car and drive on one of those side streets. I was just absolutely astounded at that area, and it's so close to downtown Durham.
It's cheek to jowl with downtown Durham,
right? And it needs to be rebuilt in a way that means something to the people who will live there, to the people who will work there, and to Durham itself, who will be proud of what they've done. And that's what we need to hope for.
What I see in that neighborhood, Bill, is a jewel in North Carolina Central that can really be the engine,
right,
for revitalizing that community around the university, with the university as a center of community. And there's still, to be fair, there are still some pockets of that community that are vibrant, that are strong, and really want to be able to build on the strengths of what it used to be and what it can be once again.
Yeah, I know there are, because I've talked to a few of those people, and I know they're working together and certainly hoping for the best, and the university is right in there with them.
Oh yeah.
So one more item in this list of items that maybe we've covered are broad expertise helping communities to mobilize to design, prove, and scale innovative solutions to deeply rooted economic and social challenges, which is kind of what we just said.
Yeah.
That's happening in the Fayetteville region. But what's stopping the South? You know, I don't, I was born in the North, and in fact, I lived in Lorain, Ohio. I'm a very old person.
Yeah.
And I lived in Lorain, Ohio, and went to high school with Toni Morrison.
Wow.
She was 2 years behind me. But I do remember her and her sister walking through the halls, because Lorain, Ohio, in those days, this was during World War II, mm-hmm. and Lorain, Ohio was very, very integrated, because the local boys had all been drafted for the military, but Lorain had a lot of industry, steel mills, shipyards, and they brought in people from Central America mostly. And a lot of my classmates in high school were from Honduras and Guatemala. And if you look at my high school yearbook and see our names, you'll see as many Spanish names as Anglo names in that yearbook. Wow. I was graduated in 1947. And
I didn't realize that. But how lucky you were to have been in the presence of Toni Morrison back when she was Chloe Wofford. So
yeah, Chloe Wofford. That's right. And if you've read anything she has said, I didn't know her, but she was very positive about living in Lorain. She said we all played together, because Lorain was very integrated in those days. As I mentioned, people from other parts of the Western Hemisphere came there to work, and her father moved to Lorain with his family, and she and her sister to work. I think he was working for the post office, and they moved from the South to Lorain.
Yeah,
and that's where Chloe. And I'm glad you remember her name. That's Chloe Wofford.
She was an amazing talent,
and she went on to Howard and married a guy named Morrison.
Yeah,
and her middle name was Antonio, so she just made her first name Tony. So that's her story.
Yeah. So yeah.
We can stop talking now. Anyway, back to this world that you're in. Bring us up to date before you became MDC. I saw in your write-up that you spent some time in federal government. You had some type of activity in the Obama administration. What's that all about?
Yes, sir. I was mainly working in the administration during the President Obama's second term. And I began in the White House in the Office of Management and Budget as the Deputy General Counsel. So the second ranking lawyer in that office. And then from there, 2 years later, I moved to one of the government agencies and became the General Counsel, the Chief Legal Officer for the U.S. Agency for International Development, our primary development funder through the federal government. Uh-huh. And those 4 years were amazing years. The time in the White House I described as it's like being on call for 2 years. I managed to make it through and learned a heck of a lot in the process.
I imagine you did. Well, now you were right from law school.
I had spent a little bit of time doing some other things before that. So prior to going to the White House, I taught constitutional law for about 10 years in South Carolina.
Where you were down in Furman?
At Furman and in Charleston, South Carolina. Oh. And I practiced law in Washington, D.C. right out of law school.
So practicing law in Washington, D.C., coming right out of Duke Law School, what kind of work were you getting?
Work that shouldn't have been coming to someone with my level of inexpertise, for sure.
Oh yeah, okay.
I was in what DC would consider to be a small law firm. So I think we had about 32 attorneys, and I was one of the few junior attorneys they had in that particular firm. But that also meant that I got a lot of responsibility early. I was able to work with clients. They let me loose on clients, uh-huh. and other counsel who we were working with. I learned a lot in that process. We were a group of litigators who did a lot of work in insurance pollution coverage. So we were working for Lloyd's of London. And we also did a lot of political work and ended up doing some work for the mayor of D.C. We represented Vice President Gore in the Florida recount in 2000. And so as a baby lawyer, I got to see that process up close. And it was an unforgettable experience.
And no celebrations after that was over.
No celebrations after that was over, unfortunately. No. But
were some of your fellow attorneys former aides in congressional offices, like with senators' offices, congressmen's offices, the lobby type people?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And one of my mentors in particular was a former committee counsel in the Senate, working for Senator Hatch at one point, Orrin Hatch from Pennsylvania, and a guy from Delaware named Biden. But I don't know what's happened with him.
No, he didn't make it.
No.
Okay, well, everybody in Congress, you weren't in Congress, you were associated with Congress.
Yes, sir.
Do most of these people, such as you, move on into private institutions and leave congressional and government roles into something like you're doing or private practice?
Eventually. That's a really good question. It covers all of those options. And what I found, I've lived in DC on three separate occasions now. First, I did actually work in Congress for a year before law school. Then when I went into practice, and then the third time when I was working in government. And one of the things that I appreciate about the time that I've spent in Washington is that you can move from a government role into the private sector, the nonprofit sector, the for-profit sector, back into government, leveraging what you've learned in the meantime to try to get it right on the second or third try. And I think I would argue that we actually benefit from that level of movement, because people bring in their new experiences and their newly gained expertise into new roles.
So do you think that you got enough getting it right, to use your phrase, to help you in your work today, in today's world?
I don't know how much I got right in the moment, but I certainly learned a lot. And I brought that into this role, thinking specifically about something like the function of government, right? And for example, we often argue in this country about the size of government. And one of the things that became clear to me working in the budget office for the government is that the real argument isn't about big government versus small government. It's really about effective government. And what is the right size for our government to meet the needs, the articulated needs of the people and its obligations to the people? That's a question we need to be asking, and a route we need to be pursuing. And I still don't think we're there yet, but I have hope.
Okay. Well, I'm glad you have hope, and keep smiling. You're still young enough. If you choose to put your feet back in the government's shoes,
it gets more and more difficult. And I know that you've had Congressman Price on your show a few times, and he's someone for whom I have a great deal of respect. And what I fear is that there are fewer and fewer people like him in government today.
Yeah, and we had a final show. The final show was, unfortunately, I was hoping to do it the 4th of July, but his wife had just died, and obviously he was in a state of mourning, so we couldn't do it on the 4th of July, but we did it a month later, I guess, in September.
Yes.
And kind of reminiscing his world. Now, you know, I've had him on the show, as you say, several times. You always from the studio in Carrboro, but I don't go there anymore. Uh-huh. And the last conversation was reminiscing about his world in Congress. And, you know, he didn't get a lot of press. He wasn't one of these congressmen like Rubio, who's in the news every day. But he worked hard, and he got things accomplished in the committees that he was involved with.
He worked really hard, and that's exactly the example that I think of, and the way in which I appreciate what he brought to the role is that he was much more concerned about being effective than being in the headlines.
Yeah, he was concerned about that, and that's the kind of government people we want, and I'm sure that even some of those that we laugh about and joke about still have good characters and try when they can to do good for their districts and their population.
I'd like to believe that everyone who holds an office of public responsibility can rise to that occasion when it's really necessary.
Yeah. Well, back to this world of the South. As we got off track with that, talking about Toni Morrison, growing up in Ohio as a kid, everybody south of Columbus were hillbillies.
Yeah.
And I didn't have any feelings other than that that's what we call them. Mm-hmm. And I didn't, my family lived in northern Ohio, and my father was a clergyman. And we had nice friends, and I don't think I knew anyone until I got to Lorraine High School, which was integrated, as I told you, and there were a number of African Americans as well as Latin Americans. Mm-hmm. But I didn't know the South that you're talking about, and that the MDC is talking about. And, you know, it's your South, it's spelled with a capital S. And I always thought South was just a direction on the map.
Oh, but it's so much more. It's
It is
a place for all time, I would say. And Bill, you know, I've been a government bureaucrat, I've been a lawyer, I've been a teacher, so I've been called a son of many things, as you might imagine.
Okay.
But I will admit to being a son of the South. I grew up in the South. This is home for me. I grew up in South Carolina.
Right.
And warts and all, in its best ways and most frustrating deficiencies. It's a place that I care deeply about.
Well, those of us now, I've lived in North Carolina for about 30 years. And do you consider North Carolina part of the South, or are we too marginal?
I most certainly consider North Carolina to be part of the South. And in many ways, it points the way to what the South can be in as we look at different parts of this really fascinating state, the amazing things that are going on in rural communities in this state. The community college system we have that I think really is second to none.
It's a great system. Yeah.
It's a great system. We've got 10 historically Black colleges and universities in North Carolina. And that's more than any other state for 4-year institutions. The history and the resources that we have here make us, I think in many ways, the envy of a lot of places in the South.
Well, a lot of my family went to Duke. My son, who was born in the North, also married a Duke girl, and they had 2 children, and both of them came to Duke. So I've kind of got that flavor pasted on me. Whether I'd rather say UNC Chapel Hill or not, or say Tar Heel rather than Duke. The Dukies.
Yeah. Well, I am a Duke grad and loyal to my alma mater, to the great disappointment of most people on my team who are mostly from Chapel Hill. So
yeah, I noticed that you have a lot of Chapel Hill people there.
I do, and they don't let me forget it either.
Well, they're playing in football in 2 weeks.
Yeah.
So you know, I don't. I tell my wife I don't want to watch a lot of football because I'm really a baseball fan, and baseball season's soon to be over, and I'm stuck with football until next March.
I'm afraid so. Yeah.
But I did live in Buffalo when the Buffalo Bills were born, so I have to be a Bill fan, like it or not.
Well, it may be a good year to be a Bills fan. So
yeah, they had a great game Sunday.
They did.
Anyway, your life is full of bright lights, and directing you into ideas that need to be explored. I guess I can read a couple of notes from your article. By paying more attention to our history, we can piece together a more complete picture of the past, allowing us to reframe historical narratives. Our past is tragic. Okay, let's stop there. Our past is tragic.
Mm-hmm.
What is our tragic past that we're talking about?
Our tragic past begins with the fact that we are having this conversation on unceded Shikori and Okanichi land, that there were native peoples here before any of us set foot on this landmass. It continues with the trade in humans that made not only the South wealthy, but the entire country wealthy. The Carolina colony itself was really a venture in the product of enslaved humans at its very beginning. But I don't think we need to stop there. I think we just need to recognize that for what it is. And it's not so much what's happened, it's what do we do going forward, knowing what's happened. And I feel like these are things that we can all learn from as to how we grow, how we make a community out of a much more diverse society than we've had 50 years ago, 100 years ago, and one that will continue to be so. It's our strength. And I think that not only can we solve these problems in the South, not only should we solve these problems in the South, but the South shows the way for the rest of the world. We are an interesting region in that we influence what we eat, we influence what we say, and we influence how we pray all across this country.
You are saying the South has this influence.
The South has this influence,
and we are thriving or learning from it.
We're learning in fits and starts from it, I would say, and in some ways, what I think is that because the racial history of this country is so much on the surface in the South, if we can honestly confront that to build a new future, we can be a model for the rest of the country.
Okay, so is your family background from slavery or from another part of the Western Hemisphere?
Bill, it's from all of the above. And, if you go back far enough, the way that I describe it was there was a ship, and below the deck of the ship, there were some people on that ship. Those are my people. Uh-huh. On the deck of the ship, there were some people on the ship. Those are my people. Waiting for them on land once they got here, there were some folks waiting for them. Those are my people. And, I would say that that is a common story in the African-American experience. But not only that, it is biologically impossible for African-Americans to have such a diverse past and for whites not to. So,
yeah, well, that's got to give you a lot of personal pride.
I am grateful for the family that I'm a part of, for sure.
Yeah. Sir, well, okay. So, what are we doing now in the South? The message I kind of got from reading your editorial and from doing a little work on the MDC file, the South needs things to happen. The South needs to change. The South needs to be brought up to. I don't say to the world of the North.
Yes.
The South needs to build up to its own values and its own adulthood.
Indeed. And I'll give you a concrete example of what it means to move from the past and into the future. The park in Raleigh, Dix Park, named after Dorothea Dix.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that park sits on hunting grounds of Native American communities.
That's right.
It was a place where enslaved people were held. Mm-hmm. It was also the site of a mental hospital that was a segregated mental hospital. Those are all problematic things, but going forward, that space can be a space where people come together. And the symbol of that, I think, is really powerful, that the continued transformation of Raleigh and the region more broadly, as exemplified by the Dix Park transformation, mm-hmm. is a lesson that we can draw upon. And I see it in other places too. Greenville, South Carolina, just opened a park called Unity Park. And Unity Park is the combination of park land in the city of Greenville that was once segregated. Ball fields, uh-huh. Public spaces that are now open to the entirety of the community. And those are the really tangible ways in which we literally make space for people to come together. I think that's it. I think that's powerful.
And so those are kind of examples that that you're laying out here for us that you can build in other parts of the South.
Yeah. Yeah. And what we're doing at MDC is telling that story more broadly. So on the 28th of October, we're going to have a panel talking about Dick's Park and talking about the transformation of Dick's Park with folks who've been a part of that process.
Does MDC have any staffers in the South? Or do you all, I saw your website with a lot of local, a lot of great looking people, but does everything emanate from Main Street and Durham?
It historically has primarily been focused on our home office in Durham, and that continues to be so. But we're increasingly getting folks from around the region. We have someone in Charleston. We have someone in Atlanta. We have folks in the Triad, and I would envision a near term in which we will have more employees across different parts of the South. And our board of directors, which is an amazing collection of individuals, really even more so represents our geographic reach, in that we've got folks from Alabama and Texas and Virginia and Georgia, as well as
that sounds that sounds promising.
Yeah.
Okay. I think so. I want our listeners to know we're talking with John Simpkins. He is the Chief Executive Officer of MDC, which is an organization you're learning about if you're listening carefully. And this show is on WCOM. WCOM is 103.5. You'll find it on your FM dial. We broadcast from a studio in Carrboro, North Carolina. And we have conversations such as this with Dr. Simpkins, and we have plenty of good music shows, and WDLC, all our staff is a volunteer. We have no paid employees at our station at WCOM, and so that's where an unemployed person can feel comfortable. So I'm employed. I don't have to worry about a paycheck.
There you go.
I just have to worry about finding people like you who have conversations of thought and occupations of meaning that I can convince to come and do a show on some afternoon, which is to be broadcast on a Monday at 5 p.m., which is our normal broadcast time. And I'm learning so much today about you and your history. And as I've read your document again and gone through the DMC MDC file, I still fussing about the South. Whoa.
Yeah.
What is it? You know, it's a great place. A lot of nice people down there. And I know we've hung people from trees, and we've done bad things, but we've done bad things elsewhere. And what's the flavor of the South that needs to be cultured? Where do I need to put my sugar and cream to make the flavor the way you want it?
Well, I think it's less for me. It is less about the way that I want it, and more about giving every individual a chance to define that on their own, as long as it doesn't infringe upon someone else's ability to enjoy their life. One of, I think, the greatest challenges that we face in the work that we do is how the Southern economy has developed really by the race to the bottom for cheap labor, whether you're talking about agriculture or textile mills or tobacco farms and tobacco curing processes. This region has often been a place where the economic structure is paying the lowest wage possible And as a result, making it really difficult for people to live better lives and for succeeding generations to live better lives. That's where I think the work needs to be done. And that's where we can really allow people to enjoy all the beautiful surroundings that we have here in this region.
You say in a sentence in one of your paragraphs, you must also think about equal distribution of power and wealth, investing in leaders of color, challenging the South's disproportionate poverty, and helping Southerners tackle debt. Now, that means individual debt, I guess you're talking about, and rather than corporate debt or public debt.
Certainly individual debt, and I would argue moral debt.
That's an interesting observation.
We have a moral debt to pay. And just as I was saying, I believe that it includes and exceeds issues of race. In North Carolina in particular, there are pockets of deep white poverty. There are pockets of deep Latino poverty. All hardworking folks who are doing the best they can to get by. But the reality in this country and in this region is that it's expensive to be poor. You pay more for the things that you need most, whether it's transportation, food, housing. All of those things come at a premium when you occupy the bottom rungs of the socioeconomic scale.
Where do you get support? Now, you say you've got some people in other, you mentioned other parts of the South, part of the MDC crowd. Where do you start building in Alabama? Where do you go to start building in Mississippi? Are these what I call deep Southern states? I've never even been in Alabama or Mississippi, and that's nothing good or bad. It's just an observation. But
yeah,
but I assume from books and from newspaper articles and hearing other stories that these Southern states have pockets of culture that need more than MDC. What need to be pried loose from their culture and brought into a culture that you're going to support and that I should support and that their offspring will support as time goes by.
And what we try to do when we engage with communities is to do so through community partners, through existing partnerships. I am grateful to have inherited a role here at MDC where we have had long-standing relationships and partnerships across the 13 states that we serve of decades long standing. One of our former distinguished board members was the late governor of Mississippi, William Winter, who was part of this whole generation of progressive Southern governors that included Terry Sanford here in North Carolina. And we have continued to build those relationships. And it's my stated goal as the leader of MDC right now is to get to all 13 of those states in a substantive way over the next year or so, and to reinvigorate those relationships. Mississippi and Alabama and the other states where we work are fascinating places, and there are people there who are doing good work. We see our role as to amplify and enable that work. We're not coming in telling people what to do. We're really coming in to listen to see how we can be helpful.
Okay. When you find a community or an organization or a neighborhood that you feel you can be helpful, how do you how do you value this? How do you see the trend in this community? You see that you're in a community or an area that needs, that you think can be helped. How do you evaluate your efforts as you're moving through that community and working with them to create what you feel and what some of them feel also is going to be the right outcome? How do you grade A, B, C, D your efforts in these communities where you're making an effort?
Well, I can tell you, we're always looking for an A, and we're working for an A. But we set those goals and measures in partnership with communities. So think about, well, what is it that you want? Do you want something tangible? Like, for example, do you want over the next 10 years to have 10,000 people in your state with some post-secondary school credential, a community college degree, a four-year college degree,
right,
or a job that pays a life-sustaining wage? We can measure that, right? We can measure that based on the inputs that we provide. Or you can ask, are you trying to really get people to have a deeper understanding of the history of their community? And we can measure that too by bringing folks together and then asking them questions afterwards. What'd you learn? What's different? What would you do different? And to use that to then inform what comes next if you're trying to bring people together around a common cause or around a view of their community. And then the other thing we can do is to look to see literally about the health of the community. Community health, you know, if you're improving access to transportation, if you're improving access to healthy food, then are you seeing less visits to the emergency room? Are you seeing fewer instances of hypertension and diabetes in the community? What's the result of those efforts that you're making to address those problems? Those are the kinds of measures that we look to determine whether or not we're having any impact.
So I can assume that some communities you've been successful.
Yes.
You've got A pluses on your scorecard.
That is true. And sometimes we haven't. And you know what? I think it's just as important, maybe even more so, to learn from those places where you haven't been successful. And we try to make that a part of the culture of our organization as a learning organization, that you can't be afraid to try. Because if you're not failing, occasionally you're probably not doing something right. You're not trying hard enough. You need to sometimes make big bets, and that's as important as doing the safe thing and making the incremental change. So we try to balance that out, but we certainly do look to learn from every opportunity that we have to work with our community partners.
What's the When you find a community that says, okay, give us a try, and you work with them for whatever channel you take, mm-hmm. and at the end of a period of time, it's a failure.
Yeah.
What happens then? And they've tried, and you've tried, and nothing has worked the way you thought it could.
Right. Sometimes things don't stick, right?
Right.
When that happens, I think you do what you do under any of those circumstances. You go back and you look at what you could have done differently, what you would do differently, and maybe even look to some of the bright spots that you can build on that point the way to the next either design of a new approach to try to tackle the same problem again, or where you'd find yourself confronting a similar problem in a different location. So those are always, as I see them, real learning opportunities, and I embrace those.
Well, you've got a pretty big staff here, and according to your website, all of them have some focus on what you and I are talking about.
Yes, sir.
And you're the head guy. So how do you work with your staff to find out where they feel they're needed, where they find out what's happening where they're needed, how they recruit people where they're needed. How do you develop the staff that you have to accomplish this? This is a big responsibility. You've taken the whole staff and put it under your arm, and you said, we're going to clean this place up.
And we don't make any small plans, do we?
No.
You know, that gets to work that's constantly underway at MDC, which is how do we develop our people? And that takes a lot of listening just to what our staff needs, what talents they possess that they actually want to put into practice to enhance our work, and giving them a path to grow within the organization. You know, this is exactly what we're engaged in right now, as a matter of fact. As we grow in size, we also want to provide opportunities for people to grow within their own career path, and to make that a clear career path through the organization and even beyond the organization. My view is that if we can see the next level of the next generation of folks who care about the South and are working in ways in the nonprofit sector, in the for-profit sector, in government and academia and community, that's a win for us. And we see great potential and possibility in our very talented team that we have.
Well, you've been there. How long have you been there?
Almost 2.5 years now.
Okay, well, stick around a while. Don't go back to Washington.
I'm having a good time here. So, huh? I'm having a great time here.
And you live in Durham?
Yes, sir, I do. I live in downtown Durham.
That's great, right in downtown, so you can walk to work.
I can walk to work, and I did it yesterday. It's a real blessing.
Yeah, during the rain. At least we're lucky that we didn't get the kind of hurricanes they're having down in the South. I have two cousins in Venice, Florida.
Oh, wow.
And I haven't been able to reach them. And I'm concerned about them. But
that is concerning. I hope they end up okay.
I hope they do too. Anyway, this has been a great conversation with you, and I'm going to talk to you again sometime and maybe get the chance to shake your hand face to face, because it would be a lot of fun to meet you personally.
I'd welcome that, Bill. I'd look forward to it.
And thanks a lot for coming, and I see our host is going to shut us off the air pretty soon. So next week, we may repeat this show next week because it's been recorded, and I know that a lot of people who know about the show want to hear it again, so we may repeat the show exactly the way it was today for others next week, and we won't charge as much.
Thank you, Bill.
Thank you.